Welcome to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke, and we're going to begin this hour with a strange story of a Seattle immigration enforcement official allegedly stealing the identities of immigrants. The chief counsel for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Seattle is charged with identity theft and wire fraud. And here with the story is KUOW reporter Liz Jones. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
Will you tell us about Rafael Sanchez?
Yes. Rafael Sanchez is the top attorney for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Seattle. His job is to manage a staff of lawyers who prosecute immigration cases in the federal court here in Seattle. These are people facing deportation, looking for asylum, different kinds of relief to stay in the U.S. And he resigned on Monday in light of these charges against him.
What is he accused of?
Charging documents filed Monday in U.S. District Court in Seattle. He's charged with one count of aggravated identity theft and another count of wire fraud. So what he's charged with is stealing the identities of seven people who are in various stages of immigration proceedings. And he used their identities to then apply for credit cards in their names, places like American Express, Bank of America, Capital One.
I heard that story this morning, and I just thought, what? It's weird. Is it? Do you know, is this just a one-off? Do you know of any? You've been covering immigration here so much, Liz. Does this signal any other larger concerns within ICE's Seattle office that we ought to know about?
Well, there is a bigger backstory here. 3 years ago, one of the attorneys who worked for Sanchez, one of the attorneys underneath him, was caught forging a document to get an immigrant deported. This went through a federal court here. That attorney pled guilty. He lost his license to practice law. The attorney representing that client called for a deeper investigation of this ICE office. Rafael Sanchez, the top attorney, was a person put in charge, reportedly, of that investigation to look into more potential fraud or misconduct within his own office. The irony here is that this investigation took place at the same time Sanchez is accused of conducting his own fraud. This fraud he's charged with goes back at about 4 years to 2013. So Matt Adams, he's an attorney with the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. He was the one that brought this complaint against the attorney forging the documents and calling for the investigation. And here he is talking about the outcome of ICE's own investigation into this internal misconduct related to the forgery case.
And one of the things that we were most disappointed about was when the government did that, you know, Mr. Sanchez came back and said, oh, well, we've looked at these other 50 to 70 cases where there was this identical form that was filed by Mr. Love. But that's all they looked at.
So he's saying here this investigation clearly did not go far enough. There's not enough accountability within the office to detect this kind of fraud or to investigate it when things like this happen.
And Liz, what do we know about the victims, the people that Sanchez allegedly stole information from?
We don't know a lot yet. There are very few details in the charging documents, but there is one example of the type of fraud that was taking place allegedly here. There's a wire communication that Mr. Sanchez sent using from his Yahoo account. And he's using the information of an immigrant who had his energy bill here with a Seattle residence, had a picture from his permanent resident card, had a page from his Chinese passport. He's just identified by initials here, so we don't know who he is. But we do know that these victims tend to be, when they're in deportation proceedings or immigration proceedings, these are very vulnerable people. We don't know if they were still in the country when this was happening, if they were already deported. And here again is Matt Adams talking about why people in this situation could be an easy target.
So if you're using their information or the information of an immigrant who's been deported, it's very unlikely that they're going to be able to come back and say, hey, you know, all of a sudden my credit went south, or why am I being billed for this when I... You know, because they're now in a country on the other side of the planet.
So as this case moves forward, these victims will likely be able to have a chance to have any damages to them rectified.
Okay. So again, these are allegations. What happens next in the case of Rafael Sanchez?
Yes, he's expected to make his initial court appearance tomorrow. And the charging documents that were filed indicate he's likely to plead guilty to these charges. That happens tomorrow morning at a hearing here in Seattle Federal Court.
Okay, Chief Counsel for the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE office in Seattle, charged with identity theft and wire fraud, and that's KUOW reporter Liz Jones filling you in. Liz, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
And you're listening to The Record. Back in a moment here on KUOW. This is KUOW Seattle. Since January 1st, Deputy Police Chief Carmen Best has been running the Seattle Police Department. She took the job on an interim basis after Kathleen O'Toole left at the end of the year. Chief Best will lead the SPD as it makes changes to its use of force policy and biased policing, and it conducts contract negotiations with the police union. Chief Best grew up in Tacoma, worked as an accountant in the insurance industry before becoming a cop in the early 90s, and I asked her about those early days.
You're one of the few people in America who wants to hear cop stories because, you know, they tell them all the time. But there's so many different things that happen along the way. It's hard to pinpoint one. But I do remember being in a foot chase one morning. So someone had carjacked, you know, stolen a car by force in one area of the city. And I was listening to the call and it wasn't near where I was. So I, you know, was paying attention, but it was outside of my area. Then I look up and there's a car, right, turning down the street in front of me. We were right across the street from Volunteer Park. So I was following the car and I'm calling it out, you know.
You knew exactly what it was?
Yes. This is the car. I double checked. Is it this plate? And dispatcher comes back. Yep, that's the plate. Oh, well, I'm right behind them and we're headed eastbound on the road here. So I follow the car. It's early in the morning, so not a lot of officers were on duty at that point, but the car goes down, eventually down a dead end road. And I figured he's probably going to jump out and bail, which he did. And so I'm running and we're all running to chase this guy and we find him and take him into custody. No big issues, except that because I wore red lipstick at the time and we were running through bushes, some of the lipstick got on my uniform and everybody thought I had been shot or injured because they had all this red on my uniform. I go, no, I'm fine. It's just lipstick. It was kind of funny. We kind of joked about it later on, but one of those interesting moments.
Well, just lipstick on the patrol officer's uniform. How many women were patrol officers at that time?
You know, I don't remember the exact number, but we've always fluctuated between 10 and 14% in Seattle.
What happened? Did you get your bad guy?
Well, I got the bad guy. Yeah, I've been off and running ever since.
How long had you been on the job at that time, you figure?
Oh, probably a couple years at the most.
What was officer culture like then? This was early 90s?
Early 90s. I came on in 1992, in January of 92, finished the academy. So by the summer of 92, I was in the field.
Well, 92, this was about the time of the L.A. riots. You had the four L.A. police officers acquitted in the beating of Rodney King. How were Seattle police at that time, did you think, treating black people and other minorities?
Well, it's always been a topic of discussion in law enforcement, and certainly I came on right after those riots had occurred. We literally had riots in downtown Seattle, and I was they stacked us up four persons to a car, and we had to go downtown and provide a presence and try to take anyone in custody who was committing, you know, obvious acts of violence.
What was going on in downtown Seattle?
There was some sort of melee, so it was really tough. I mean, I'm African-American, I'm a woman, I'm very sensitive to the issues involving race and police and sort of the history there. And at that time, it was, you know, it was boiling over. It was very volatile. I didn't feel any less committed to the work, but I certainly was paying attention to what was happening in the field. I think we do a lot better job now. I don't think that the department even then was bringing on people who intentionally was bringing on people who had biases, but I think we do a lot better job now about training, about looking for those types of issues before people come into this career.
Well, this was early 90s. This is maybe 20 years before the consent decree when the federal government stepped in to try to right some problems. And I think I read that you said officers sometimes just had to do a rubber stamp on use of force statements. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, we get the use of force statements. I thought our agency did a really good job about documenting force because some agencies at that point weren't even writing it down. And Seattle would, if they were forced to use, write it down, document it. You had to bring it in. A supervisor would look at it. But the supervisor is reading the report. They're not there at that time. They're not doing any extra investigation other than, you know, they're reading the report. They're looking, maybe talking to the officer about what happened. And then, you know, barring something in the report that says I did something wrong or in violation of policy, you sign off on it, right? Well, we're a lot more engaged and involved in what happens in use of force now. And with the advent of in-car video, people have cameras on their phones now. There's a whole lot more investigation that will go into force reporting than went into it before. So what I meant by that was that there just wasn't that level of extra oversight. So they were signing off and that was it. Now there's a whole lot more that goes into it.
As I said, in 2012, a Seattle police officer shot and killed John T. Williams, a Native American woodcarver who was homeless at the time, and that helped launch a 7-year Justice Department investigation and reform process. Can you tell me a story that illustrates how things have changed since 2012?
Well, there's a whole lot of processes that have changed. Even for myself going out in the field, I mean, the technology that we have now, you know, there's computers in the car that, you know, give you updates and information, and you can see the policies on the screen. We have 5 times more training than we ever had before. So we're training on a lot of different issues. We have crisis intervention training that everybody's required to have. So all of those things have made the job a lot different. We didn't at that point have cameras in the vehicles. Now we have cameras in the vehicles. We have cameras on the officers. It's a different job, you know, in that regard. The technology, the amount of reporting that's involved, the amount of oversight that the supervisors have on their employees. And now we have a force review board, a whole board of people who actually look anytime serious force is used about every aspect of force. And not just, like in the past, the force at that moment, but everything leading up to it. You know, did you de-escalate? Could you have avoided this? Could you have slowed it down a bit? Could you have called for backup? They weren't always looking at all those aspects in the past. It was more or less, you know, somebody did something to you and you reacted, and of course it was in policy because you were being attacked. But now we're looking at just the whole big picture of what goes into it. And it makes us better police officers because we're responding better to these situations.
Last summer, Chief Best, 2 Seattle police officers killed a pregnant mother, Charlena Lyles, and Seattle's Force Review Board said the officers acted within policy. The lawyer for Lyles' family said, until there are changes to policy and training, the same events could happen tomorrow. Does SPD need to change its policy or training in light of what happened to Charlena Lyles?
I would say, first let me say this, it was nothing less than a horrific tragedy, what happened there. And there are a whole host of things that came into play that made that incident at that moment in time occur. I think there's a whole lot of failed systems that just didn't work in terms of mental health and other things that could have helped prevent those officers from being there at that moment dealing with that situation at that time. So that being said, I think that we need to work on a lot of different systems to make sure that no one falls through the cracks ends up in a situation like that.
Could this just as well happen tomorrow?
I mean, I can't predict the future. I'm not clairvoyant. Certainly there could be a situation where an officer-involved shooting occurs. I think that we are always looking at the potential for a tragedy. So we're trying to do everything that we can to prevent it through our training. And we will review every incident. And this incident isn't done yet. I mean, there'll still be an inquest. I mean, there's still an investigation that will occur further into it. We've done the initial, what the Seattle Police Department has done, the Force Review Board, but there's a whole larger gamut of information that will be looked at through the inquest process. And anything we can glean or learn from that, you know, we'll do that because we want to do a good job. And nothing is more important than the sanctity of life, right? And that under all circumstances, we're going to try to make sure that we do everything to protect life.
You know, the Seattle Seahawk, Michael Bennett, recorded a letter for ESPN, and I'd like your reaction to some of what he said.
Charlena Lyles, Michael Brown, Sandra Bland. How can we trust each other when so many of our people are lost? Freddie Gray, Tamir Rice. How can we trust each other when there's been no justice? How can we trust our system when nobody's been to jail? I don't really know how to make somebody value another human's life. An officer has to realize what it is to like to be a black man and what the history of police in the black community. It's so emotional for us to forgive because we don't know how the next story is going to stop. At any moment, every black person that's in the car, when they see a police officer, they don't know what to expect. They don't know what to expect that this could be their last moment. Should they call their family? Should they tell their wife they love them? Should they call their kids and tell them they might be home tonight? They don't know. They just don't know. And I think when all those things have happened, it's just hard for us to trust again.
Chief Best, what does the Seattle Police Department do to rebuild that trust, that lost trust that Michael Bennett's talking about?
It's really important that, you know, we listen I don't take what Michael Bennett or any other person is saying lightly. We know there's a history. So part of what we want to do is make sure, well, not just part, but a great part of what we want to do is make sure that we are talking to our officers, we're bringing the right people onto the department, that our department, for one, reflects the community that we serve. So there's that natural relationship building in that aspect of it, but also making sure that we're doing the appropriate amount of training and talking to officers about these issues of bias, of race, of history. We're not avoiding it. We're hitting it dead on because they are so important and because it does matter how people perceive us. If we can't build trust, we're not going to be an effective police department. So we've got to start at the basics by having that dialogue and trying to build trust. I absolutely can understand why there are concerns. I don't think anybody cannot understand that. But what are we going to do about it? How are we going to make it better? That is what I'm looking to do. Nothing is more important than building community trust. We have to do it.
What does Seattle Police have to do? How do you rebuild that broken trust he's talking about?
Well, you have to be visible. People have to get to know the officers in situations that aren't just, you know, crime situations or those types of issues. We have to be visible in the community, engage with community people. They have to see us at the fairs and parades and out there actually being a part of the community, not apart from the community. And so as we do that, as we get more engaged, as we build more programs, as people see us as the people that we are, this is just a uniform. It certainly isn't my life. It's just what I wear at my job. I think that building those relationships will make a difference. In fact, I was talking to one of the college presidents recently, and she was saying how much she really enjoys and likes some of the officers that she knows, but she's still leery about the ones that she doesn't know. So I told her, I said, we've got to make opportunities for people to get to know more of us and to know us in a way that's on a human level and humanize what we're doing here and who we are. Because I think once that happens, we will build trust.
I'm talking with Seattle's Chief of Police, Carmen Best. You know, Chief, given the history of police culture, I could imagine someone saying a black woman, big city police chief, that's unusual. That's a culture clash.
I'm saying it's about time. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I just wonder how you're living it. How do you reflect on that?
You know, I think, like I said, I've been in this job for almost 30 years. And while some people will focus on that, I just focus on the fact that I've got the skills and the capability to do the work. I've been here doing it a long time. I'm committed to it. So
you get tired of being asked about race and gender?
I understand this. It's a huge issue in society, so I wouldn't avoid that. But I also want to make it very clear that that's not the criteria by which I am applying for this position. I am strictly here because I think I'm capable and I know that I can get the job done.
The Chief of Police in Seattle, Carmen Best. I really appreciate this time. It's good to meet you.
Great. Thank you. Me too.
Carmen Best, Seattle's police chief, at least for now. She's got the interim job. Seattle's mayor, Jenny Durkin, wants a new chief in the job by summer, and interim Chief Best's resume is on her desk. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. More in a moment. Glad you're listening to KUOW. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Tacoma will name a waterfront park, at least a slice of the park, after former resident and science fiction writer Frank Herbert. Frank Herbert, known for Dune. He wrote Dune. He also wrote Children of Dune and God Emperor of Dune and Dune Messiah, Chapter House Dune, many other novels without Dune in the title, and loads of short fiction, too. And later this year, his name will be on the Dune Peninsula and Frank Herbert Trail. It's an 11-acre part of Point Defiance Park. It's built on a former toxic waste site. A former toxic waste site, and the people who named it for Herbert think that is perfect. Parks Commissioner Eric Hanberg, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you so much for having me.
You grew up in Tacoma. Did you know Frank Herbert was from Tacoma?
You know, I didn't know until I finished Dune as a child, and I got to the end of it, and I was blown away, and there at the end on the author page, Frank Herbert from Tacoma, Washington. And I didn't know people came from Tacoma. It was a new thing for me, so it was very exciting.
Well, we'll get to why a former toxic waste site can be so appropriate. Tell us about this park. Where is it?
This park is at the very north part of Tacoma, and it's never been opened to the public. It's this byproduct of the Asarco smelter that was there for decades that was used to create a breakwater to create a yacht basin next to Point Defiance Park. And it just sat there. It was this almost like this moonscape, weird black rock out there, no public access. And it's now going to be opened as a park later this summer or early fall.
Mm. It sounds otherworldly and kind of lovely. Is it safe for human beings?
Absolutely. So this is part of a reclamation that the EPA has been leading, and Metro Parks is, of course, very much excited about, that we can open a new public waterfront park, as you said, 11 acres, with sweeping vistas of Commencement Bay. So all of the bad stuff has been locked, you know, under the seals that EPA has been putting down, and the rest will be very safe for public enjoyment.
And what is that bad stuff sealed off underground, like heavy metals?
Yes, it's whatever the byproduct is from making the copper in the smelter, and they use this slag material. And as long as it's not, you know, being exposed to the air or the water, and as long as it's trapped in place, we can have these public amenities on, you know, several feet on top of it.
What do you know about any deposits of spice that might be at this location?
The spice must flow, as they say, yeah.
That's a Dune reference, which
That's
gets
right.
us to why put a park on top of a toxic dump and name it after Frank Herbert?
Well, one of the great things about Frank Herbert and that novel Dune is the environmental message that informed it. And, you know, when people think of Dune, they think of sandworms and the spice, but there's this really strong environmental theme that runs through the book, and it's one of the very first environmental novel that is out there about, you know, the desertification when we aren't taking care of our environment. And there's a story that Frank Herbert's son tells about seeing his hometown destroyed by the smelters, you know, the air pollution, and that it inspired the environmental message of Dune. So that's something that Tacoma can say we did. I'm not sure it's a legacy we want, but that is something that our history did.
Right. I understand Herbert used to say Tacoma's air was so thick you could chew it.
Yes. That smelter kicked off a lot of bad byproduct that we're still cleaning up today.
Yeah. And as far as for Dune, it wasn't always a desert planet, as we come to find out. We made terrible decisions.
That's right. So you have this story in the novel about how you know, they poisoned the planet, and then they try to reclaim it. And here we took a poisoned area, and we are reclaiming it for the public. And the fact that this land is what is formed from the byproduct that inspired the environmental message of Dune, what a great place to create Dune Peninsula and Frank Herbert Trail.
Now, Eric, there are a lot of Dune fans worldwide. Is this going to become a major pilgrimage there in Tacoma?
Wouldn't that be great if we captured all of those Dune fans coming here? I would love to see, you know, Frank Herbert or sandworm-inspired art at this park. And maybe when the new Dune movie comes out, we can have a special outdoor premiere there.
There's a new Dune movie coming?
Yes, the director of Blade Runner and Arrival is making a Dune movie. It's very exciting.
The old Dune movie did pretty well. Have you heard from Kyle MacLachlan or David Lynch?
Let's see if we can get him here for that, maybe.
Okay, that's Eric Hanberg, Metro Parks Commissioner in Tacoma, and one of the people behind the new Dune Peninsula at Point Defiance Park and Frank Herbert Trail, in honor of the celebrated Tacoman and science fiction author. Eric, thanks a lot for reminding us about the environmental history of Tacoma and talking spice and sandworms with us. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. If you want fewer oil tankers here, drink more wine from British Columbia. That advice comes from a Seattle writer because of an unusual fight between two Canadian provinces. The fight involves an oil pipeline, the Salish Sea, and a nice Chardonnay. And here to tell you about oil, water, and wine is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Good morning. Do not mix water with wine, but then again, Bill, don't mix oil with
water.
Water,
yes. Yeah. So how did this begin, Vaughn?
Well, this is a erupted into a national story in Canada. And you're right, a battle between two provinces. So the national government approved the twinning of an existing pipeline that comes from Alberta and comes all the way to Vancouver and would then be used to transport heavy Alberta oil, bitumen, on tankers
B-I-T-U-M-E-N.
To global market.
Yes, B-I-T-U-M-E-N, bitumen.
Yeah, yes. It's basically heavy oil, really gunky stuff, and very controversial. The big concern in British Columbia is that if one of these tankers that's hauling this stuff off to markets overseas wrecks, you're going to have a whole lot of water through full of bitumen, and nobody's 100% sure, it's very controversial, whether or not it sinks or dissolves. So there's the environmental issue. But the pipeline was approved by the national government and says it's going to go ahead. Construction hasn't started. British Columbia government, the new one, is opposed, and they announced about 10 days ago that they were going to scientifically research the threat of oil spills on the coast. And while that scientific research is going on, the province was going to temporarily ban increased shipments of this heavy oil from Alberta through British Columbia. This has triggered a giant constitutional issue in Canada because pipelines that connect two provinces are national responsibility, not provincial. The ports belong to the national government, not the province. And this project was approved by the national government. Province of Alberta, which has the oil bill, has responded by saying what you're doing is illegal and unconstitutional, and in return, Alberta is boycotting British Columbia wine. They are the second largest customer in the world, other than British Columbians, for BC wine. And so this one actually hurts a bit, and Alberta is threatening more retaliation. Both provinces are looking to the national government to referee this thing, and the national government is basically hoping to lower the temperature on it without having to step in and use the courts or use a sledgehammer to settle this thing.
So as Alberta bans the import of British Columbia wine, and by the way, canceled talks about buying British Columbia hydropower. I mean, this is quite a fight. We've got an interest here. This would multiply the tanker traffic around the San Juans and through the Strait of Juan de Fuca from one tanker per week to more than one oil tanker per day. Does the government of Washington State have any say in this?
Well, you know, Joel Connolly knows British Columbia as well as many British Columbia journalists. He's been coming up here since the early 1970s.
This is the Seattle PI, columnist I quoted saying, support BC, buy their wine.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's raised the issue. I don't know if Washington State's weighed in on it yet, the governor there. The governor was up here a little while ago in a nice meeting with the premier of BC. But it's really hard to see how this thing is going to get settled. It's probably going to end up as a court battle. British Columbia government bill is quietly hoping that the company will just realize this thing is just too much trouble, cancel the project, and walk away. It's a $7.5 billion Canadian project, so it's not small. In Alberta, they're facing an election next year. The premier there in Alberta, Rachel Notley, is facing an election next year. She's had a big bump in the opinion polls because of this issue. It's bumped her standing with Albertans who are saying, well, you're standing up for our province. And she's threatening more retaliation. There's some thought that the next target might be craft breweries. Premier of British Columbia, John Horgan, is saying, oh, well, you know, why don't we calm down here and, you know, let's think about sending it to court or something like that. The irony, both premiers are members of the New Democratic Party, Canada's party of the left.
Right.
They are the
only
premiers. Yeah.
No.
And they're friends. They were staffers here in the 1990s in the NDP government of the 1990s. Rachel Notley got married in British Columbia. Her kids were born in British Columbia. She knows BC very, very well. And frankly, Bill, I think she knew exactly where to poke the BC government in the eye with this threat to the wine industry, because British Columbia is very, very proud of its wine industry, very, very happy. It's a big industry here. And for Alberta to boycott us, and the Alberta government runs the liquor distribution branch so they can stop ordering BC wine, and they've done that. This thing has gotten really, really messy.
And it's strange for Washingtonians who, from afar, are trying to keep things straight. We think of, as you said, we've got two liberal leaders in these provinces, and this has been signed off on by Justin Trudeau, who we down here think of as an environmentalist, right?
You're right, and he had a town hall meeting in British Columbia in the middle of all this in a place called Nanaimo up on Vancouver Island, and he was shouted down by the crowd to the point where the police had to remove the protesters from the hall. Trudeau got one of the roughest rides he's ever got in a public meeting on this. British Columbians are not happy with him for saying that this pipeline must go ahead, the tankers must go ahead, this project is essential for the national economy.
Again, KOW has reported on how this could bring the tanker traffic around the San Juan Strait of Juan de Fuca from something like one tanker per week to more than one oil tanker per day. And we've been talking about this Alberta-BC fight and how oil and water meet a nice Pinot Gris with our friend Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Vaughn, thanks a lot.
Stay tuned. I'm hoping to be embedded with the troops in the war zone next.
Oh, okay. We'll want to hear that story. Thank you, Vaughn.
Bye-bye.
It's the record on KOW. More stories to come. An incomprehensible story, but one that our next guest says, you know, I can understand. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Do you remember where you were when the Hale-Bopp comet passed over this Earth? Do you remember what happened next?
On March 26, 1997, in a mansion inside a San Diego gated community, 39 people were found dead.
You could see the bodies are coming out. I hope that's not a body.
Neatly tucked into bed, dressed in black t-shirts, sweatpants, brand new Nikes, and armbands that read, Heaven's Gate Away Team.
They ingested phenobarbital and a liquor as vodka. They just drunk it, laid down, and basically went to sleep.
Who does that, right? That was incomprehensible. It was crazy. But my next guest says one person's crazy is another person's normal. Glenn Washington, welcome to you.
Hey, Bill. Great to be here.
It's good to talk with you again. KOW listeners know you for your show, Snap Judgment. But your latest project is about the Heaven's Gate cult. This happened 20 years ago. Would you remind us more about what happened there?
Sure. I think the Heaven's Gate came to consciousness, came to national consciousness when one morning people found these bodies in a San Diego mansion. And they were followers of one man who thought he was leading them to ascend to the next level on and get on a comet and ride away.
Yeah, a comet. It was the sign that a UFO was coming to take them away, something like that?
Yes, specifically they believed there was some sort of extraterrestrial body behind the UFO, and they were going to get on it and fly away with them.
And as I said, all this sounds weird, otherworldly, impossible to believe. Why did it make some sense to you, Glenn?
Well, I remember when I first heard about this, I was in a bar, and I was looking at this thing, and it kind of, these police pictures came up, and everyone stopped for a minute, and you know, everyone was looking at it. And, you know, 90 seconds in, everyone got back to drinking again. But I couldn't do that. I kept staring. I wanted to turn the TV back up because I had grown up in an organization that seemed very similar to what they were talking about, the Heaven's Gate community. And given another twist, one more turn or something like that, that my group could have done something very, very similar. And that's what got my interest in this. Maybe my interest level was at 11 when everybody else's was maybe at 3.
Right. You grew up in this, at the time it was called the Worldwide Church of God, and you've called it an apocalyptic cult. You had a charismatic leader. How did he say the end times would go down?
It was a terrible picture. He talked about a beast power that was going to come and create a great tribulation, and he painted the picture of this beast power. And you know, as a kid, I didn't quite understand what was happening because some of it was metaphorical, but it was going to be bad. And everyone who didn't know the special knowledge and the special secrets, you all were in big trouble. And even those of us who understood, probably only one third of us would make it out to pass this great tribulation. There's a lot of talk in my organization that we were going to escape this worldwide catastrophe by hiding out in the caves of Petra, in the Syria and Jordan, and stay there for some 3.5 years while everyone else burned.
Well, Glenn, beast power, apocalypse, and tribulation. Honestly, it sounds like the Bible to me.
Well, you know, that's the whole thing. And Heaven's Gate was largely, they may even have seen themselves as a type of Christian. The Bible played a very, very big role in their theology. You know, at the end of the day, it's all about faith and belief. I'm not comfortable necessarily saying that one type of belief is more crazy than another. It's all in the end about what do you believe this book, these people, these teachers are saying to you.
I want to talk about that idea that one belief might not be more crazy than another. Before we leave your apocalyptic cult, Glenn, do you mind me asking, I'm sure you thought of this. Do you think you would have taken fatal drugs, as the Heaven's Gate members did, if you had been asked to?
I left my organization when I was in my late teens. Mm-hmm. But previous to that, I was a true believer, and I would like to sit here, Bill, and tell you, no way, I wouldn't do anything crazy like that. But I was a true believer. I did believe at least the general principles of the group I was born into. And I think about it all the time. Would I have drank the Kool-Aid, so to speak? Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't know. I don't know. I do know this. I've guesstimated that 70% of the people I grew up with would. And since, you know, I've been doing Heaven's Gate and talking about this project and going back and speaking to some of the people I grew up with, and they keep telling me, nah, man, you know, the real number's closer to 90%.
Hmm. This is Glenn Washington. You know him from Snap Judgment, and his latest project is about the Heaven's Gate cult. And Glenn, why? What do you know about why some people believe crazy cultish things? Because you've been there.
Again, is it crazy or cultish? I think when you talk about a cult, I think it's important maybe to help define it. You're talking about someone, a group with a charismatic leader, mm-hmm. A group, and the beliefs themselves, for some whatever reason it is, instead of putting you into the community at large, they oftentimes make you reject that community at large. And oftentimes as well, there is an apocalyptic aspect. And you put all these things together, a charismatic leader, an inward-looking group, and an apocalyptic thing. And then you start getting the makings of a cult. Now, the beliefs themselves, you know, like I said, people believe a lot of things. And
yes.
I don't know that one particular belief is any more crazy than another. I just know that these things, it's really about the community. And it's a community that brings people into these organizations, and sometimes it's a community that's gone astray when something horrible like this happens. The community, people who are searchers, people who are those people looking for their own divine, those oftentimes are the best kinds of people. And it's easy to subvert that sort of real inclination to be a better person. And I think that what oftentimes keeps people in these groups is that maybe this is the first time they felt love. Maybe the first time they felt acceptance in a certain way, that they are actually a part of something, something bigger than themselves. And when you don't have that and you get a taste of it, it's really hard to walk away.
You know what, Glenn? You are describing almost word for word what a former white supremacist told us on this show last week about that's how he described neo-Nazi groups. Do you still think that one idea is no more crazy than another?
I think that we're in the middle of witnessing a collective grasp, a collective seizing of absurdity in our whole political system. I don't think that it's crazy. I don't think that believing that Hail Bop is a extraterrestrial is any more crazy than ripping apart families on national television because one person was born in another country 30 years ago. I think that I'd rather believe in Hail Bop.
When you can relate, Glenn, to somebody who believes something crazy, how does that affect your life? I mean, your job is to get inside other people's stories. Are there no stories that challenge your ability to say, hey, a story is a story?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, I think the best storytelling is about empathy. And can you, as you just said, Bill, can you feel someone else's story? And yes, I think my perspective has given me access to other people's experience in this way. But there's lots of things. I think the thing that's so hard to understand is how there's something going on right now, and maybe it's an American stain, that we've got to find somebody to hate. And maybe hate is the opposite of empathy, but I think that the stories that I do find hard are people who really and truly do hate someone for no other reason. You mentioned that the white supremacists, and a lot of them, and you see this, that a lot of them are radicalized for one reason or another, but that comes out of, I'll join your group if you give me love. But even then, when you really talk to some of these guys, and they'll mouth platitudes that someone told them, but do they really hate brown people at the end of the day? Sometimes I think yes, sometimes I think no.
So are you saying sometimes you think, you know, that's a story. I used to believe crazy stories. People need they need a story, and they need community. And these people, they could drop that story and pick up a different one. You don't like how? Is that
people
what you're
do.
Getting at?
People do drop their story. I mean,
the former white supremacist. I was talking to him, and I said, you know, I want to talk about. It feels scary that you're to know what you're capable of. And he stopped me. He said, was capable of. And it just hung in the air, you know?
I'm right with you here, Bill. I think that it is scary to see yourself doing things that you can't imagine anymore. But I don't think that anyone gets away from it. I think that it's always a good reality check to think, oh, the minute you think you're so much better and removed from someone else, to maybe give yourself pause to examine your own ways that are broken of looking at the world. I am specifically about this white supremacy stuff. These guys can do horrible things and engage in horrible acts of crazy hatred, and you see them foaming at the mouth. And it all seems, their belief systems, it sometimes seems so fragile that in spite of this raging person, do you hate your half-sister? And then you see them switch. It's just, we don't make any sense, our beliefs. I think we got, that's one thing you learn in this whole thing is like, I guess stop asking people what they believe and getting into what they do. At least it makes more sense for me.
This is something I talk about a lot. I mean, my wife, my coworkers are listening to this. Oh, no, it's another Bill Radke talking about how we are storytellers. That's, you know, I describe it as I'm sitting in my own personal movie theater watching the Bill Radke Short Film Festival, yeah. Where I describe the world. Anyway, I'm with you, Glenn, and you're a professional listener and teller of stories. What do you do with that information then? How do you go out in the world? What can we take away from that way of looking at the world as a festival of stories?
I take away this. This is a big deal for me.
Me too.
When I was little and growing up in this cult and, you know, and it had a white supremacist element to it and had a bunch of misogyny element to it. And I remember being so crazed, afraid and crying and being in a closet. What's wonderful about narrative, what's wonderful about personal narrative is that you can end your story where you want it to be. And oftentimes, if you ask somebody on the street what their story is, they'll tell you something that is rooted in trauma because they haven't gotten past it. They'll tell you their story stops maybe in that closet, maybe with that person, maybe at the end of that boot or that belt or that strap. But what's so great about personal narrative is that you can go back and you can grab that little person's hand and you can end that story wherever you want to do it. And when you take when you go back and take yourself and you put yourself not locked in someone's screaming closet, but where you want to be, that doesn't just change the story. It changes the storyteller. It changes the person who's telling that story. It changes you. And I cannot emphasize enough. I can't tell you how wonderful it is to get back your own story from the demons who maybe have caged it and stolen it from you.
That is so true, because we know that stories change. That's what stories do. So when you think of it that way, you know, possibilities open up. I want to ask you, because we just have 2 minutes left here, Glenn, that you've said that storytelling has the power to remind us of our humanity. And some people think our stories are driving us apart because we've gotten so addicted to our own brand of stories. How do you reflect on that?
I just don't think we're telling each other. We're not listening or not telling stories at all anymore. I think I remember watching Crossfire and having, you know, these two idiots braying at each other and feeling dirty at the end of it. And then listening to someone actually tell me a story. And it was a story that touched on a lot of elements of race and class and of culture. But it wasn't, but all they were doing was saying what happened to them. And the listeners, all of a sudden, they weren't left and right anymore. They were just the audience. This happened to me. And we don't do that anymore. We don't give anyone the courtesy of listening to what happened to them. And we try, it seems like this maddening kaleidoscope of media, its actual purpose is to stop empathy. Again, maybe that... Do we think it's a real good idea for American children to have their parents torn away from them? If we actually listen to the story of one of those kids, would we inflict that pain on them? The only way you do that is by stopping empathy. And so at the end of the day, I don't think we're telling each other our story. I think we're forbidding that process and just getting deeper and deeper into a world without story.
Glenn Washington is the host and executive producer of the storytelling podcast, Snap Judgment. The next episode is a special that was 1 year in the making. It's called Counted, an Oakland Story. And his most recent project is a podcast called Heaven's Gate, which at heart is a story about belief, and we're tweeting out a link to that show. Glenn Washington, it's great to talk with you. Thank you for joining us.
Great being here, Bill. Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW. Our producers, Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, Bree Ripley on social media, and I'm Bill Radke. Appreciate you listening. Let's do it again tomorrow.